And so when we think of Jesus, especially evangelicals, I'm my church, non-denominational, maybe it's us, but when we think of Jesus, he could have been in any race, in any era, in any region of the world. It was just Jesus came, right? But there is a specific reason he came as the seed of Abraham in the fullness of time when he did and all of that. The two of the gospel writers make it a point to begin the story of Jesus with a genealogy. Why? Because your backstory matters. And if the Son of God himself doesn't shy away from a genealogy, neither should we. In fact, Matthew's genealogy of Jesus includes some shadiness, like some really questionable bits of the story that are not tucked away in the closet, but are actually foregrounded. Yes, Tamar, yes, we'll say her name, you know. Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, we'll say her name. Why? Because there's a way of saying that this is exactly how redemption works. Redemption is not the forgetting of your past, it's the restoring and perfecting of your story. So to be a Christian is not to kind of have a version of theology where God just kind of takes me and I'm spiritual, but God somehow floods and fills every detail of my story in such a way that he perfects it and makes it new. That's what we need.
So side note, these are 10 sermons, actually. Each one of them can be their own platform. Okay, so, all right, we are
sorry,
on number
sorry,
five.
Sorry, Sarah,
no,
keep going,
good,
keep going.
It's good, dividing life into secular and sacred compartments. Was it Ron Sider? Who was it that said, whether the issue is marriage and sexuality or money and care for the poor, evangelicals today are living scandalously unbiblical lives. And this is a very easy one for me personally to gloss over because I think, no, I've embraced the brother Lawrence. You know, he is always here. But you know what? When it comes to how I rest, this is where I start to pick things apart in an unhealthy way. I'm tired. I just want to watch an episode of Frasier because I love Frasier.
I love Frasier.
I know.
It's the best.
It's the best. It's so witty. But then I start bargaining with God. Like, am I allowed to do that? Did I read the Gospels today? And then I start feeling this bifurcation happening in me that I can't really be fully God's and watch Frasier at the same time. What is that? And I don't think it's because I'm looking at it as a sin. I think it's because, would you watch this, God? Like, is this okay? You know, I laugh hilariously, and at the end, I'm just so tickled and delighted, and yet, is that okay for me to delight in this, you know? Okay, so moving on to number six, unless you had anything. Doing for God instead of being with God. So obviously in our Western culture, being productive is a high value. And we have a high value for efficiency and for things looking good. Within minutes of meeting someone, the question is often, what do you do? Our identity gets lost in our doing. But we can't give what we don't possess, which is why this rhythm of immersing ourselves in the love of God is the only thing that fills the reservoir that we are trying to tap into when we are with other people. And our sense of worth, when we are a human doing instead of a human being, gets wrapped up in something that is going to destroy us. We constantly have, but it's on autopilot. Again, to use that phrase, this will happen to us every day. The only way to fight that tide is to put ourselves under the love of God. Who does God say that I am?
Yes.
That takes time to sit in that. It takes time in silence to shed the things that are being poured on us every day or the things that I have wrapped my controlling, grasping fingers around. It takes time in the presence of God to feel that grip loosen and to allow myself to be okay with the questions that I have and the doubts that I have and the fear that I have and the frustrations that I have, etc.
It is really hard to sit, isn't it? Like even quiet times, you know, evangelical quiet times or morning prayer or prayer books. I mean, there's always something telling us what's the next thing to say is, or the next section of scripture to read is, and all of that is good, of course. That is a part of our spirituality. But there's also something deeply healthy about being able to sit and be. The way that couples who've been married a lot of years can actually go out and just sit together and be together. Not on their phones. I mean, what a bunch of weirdos, you know? What? You can sit in a restaurant and not be staring at your phones every few minutes? And just that ability to silence everything else that I was reading this morning, one of the few mornings recently where I've had time to sit. In Mark, I think it's 5, where Jesus calls the disciples, and he says, and he called the disciples to be with him, and then to go, and then to have authority. And I think there's something really interesting about that flow. There's authority, there's purpose, but there was presence first. Just be with me. He called them to himself to be with me. Be with me. Stay with me. And this is, look, if we wanted to pause here for just a moment longer, I think for all of us in ministry, one of the great lies is that Jesus will ask us every day, do you love the church? Do you love your church? Do you love your parish? And yet, when failed Peter meets the risen Jesus on the shores of the beach, and Jesus reinstates him, he doesn't say, Peter, don't you love the kingdom? Don't you love the gospel of the kingdom? Peter, do you believe in the mission or not? He says, Peter, do you love me? And I find that so interesting because that's how John records it. John doesn't record Peter's first call, but one of the gospel, other gospel writers do. Peter's first call was, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. The first call was about a purpose, but the deeper call, the renewal of his call, was about a person. And I've been working at the same local church for 18 years. 6 years into it, we had a massive scandal from the founding senior pastor. 13 months after that, there was a shooting that happened on our campus. 2 teenage girls lost their lives that day. And in those moments, when you're struggling with your why, you don't get your calling strengthened because you love the church. You don't get your calling renewed because you just love people. You only press on because you love Jesus. And this may seem like a basic thing, doing for God instead of being with God. Oh, yeah, I've heard that. Right. But I'm just saying to all of us here, we will never last in ministry if we're in this because we love the mission or the people or the church. And I'm not trying to create a false duality. Of course, we also have to love. Right. We will feed the sheep. But the beating heart of all of this is Christ's love for us and our love for him. Amen? Okay.
A couple of symptoms that you may be falling into this category of doing for instead of being with. Is there a constant underlying insecurity that you note coming up? You're questioning, oh, how was I received when I gave that message? What did they think of me? If that is sort of constantly in the back of your mind, it could be an invitation that God is saying, come be with me so I can tell you who you are. I want to give you your worth and your value. And then, of course, another symptom is just if you just constantly feel overloaded and overwhelmed. You're carrying the world on your back. He never asked us to do that. It's an invitation. Come be with me. Shed this. Take off that yoke that I never gave you in the first place. Okay, so number 7, another symptom is of unhealthy spirituality is spiritualizing away conflict. So the way that we do that is, and we all deal with conflict differently just based on our personalities, right? Perhaps when you experience tension or conflict, you are the, let's smooth this over. Let's try to get around this, not really have to deal with it. Like if we can just get kind of this way around it, then we're good. I'm a blamer. If there's conflict, it's got to be someone else's fault and not mine. It's really hard for me to sit with conflict in a way that helps me see where I am the culprit. Maybe another way of dealing with conflict that is part of your personality is that you just want to work through it. How can I just put my head down and work this out? Or maybe this is all my fault, so how can I fix this, you know, with my best intentions? And yet, all three of those, either avoiding or taking it on yourself and trying to fix it, or blaming other people, these are ways of entertaining false peace. And Jesus was never like this, and he had conflict all the time. He had conflict from the people closest to him because he was not doing what they wanted him to do. And so whether it's conflict that we create in our own right living, or if it's the kind of conflict that just comes from people living together with other people, it will be a part of our lives all the time. And go ahead.
No. I was just going to ask you to give an example of a false peace that we're tempted to do, but maybe you're getting there.
No, that's a good idea. Do you have one?
No.
Well, one way that we can keep a false peace is when we notice something that is different than our own personal preference, and we act like it's fine that someone else is, if something, not just a personal preference, but if something is really touching against what we know to be right or our values, but we're really concerned about what this other person will think if we bring this up and say, I've got a question about this, or I'm curious why we're doing it this way, or, you know, I would actually prefer if we did it this way. We're unwilling to speak up because we're worried about what someone else will think. That's a way of keeping false peace. Mm. Let's just leave it alone and see if it kind of works itself out.
It's good. I was thinking of something a parishioner shared with me recently, which maybe I'll code it enough that you know this isn't uncovering their story, but they were saying to me that they have an adult, a child who still lives in the home with them, and they have this kind of arrangement that, you know, if you use the kitchen, you clean up your mess. And repeatedly, this adult child is not cleaning up their mess. Now, I don't know if you have adult children living with you, but apparently, you know, this can be a thing, right? I have a teenager, and it's already a thing. So this parent said, you know, it's just so stressful to me, and I hate seeing the kitchen messy, so I end up just cleaning it up. I end up just doing it, and weeks go by, and this is what is happening. Now, there's a couple ways to spiritualize this conflict. The one, or to avoid it, or to create kind of a false peace. The one is to say, well, it's okay, I'm just a servant. I'm just being a servant. Like, I know, I'm here to serve my child. They're going through such a difficult time. They're searching for a job. They're doing this. So I know we talked about them cleaning up after, but it's okay. Lord, make me a servant. You know, I'll just do this, Lord. This is my cruciform life, right? You know, doing that. But then what happens is over time, you start to resent that then the child is not thanking you for cleaning up after them. So they come home like nothing ever happened. Like, no, I didn't leave 6 dishes out in the counter. And, oh, well, look, it's all cleaned up by magic elves, you know. And so then the temptation is that the presenting issue is actually my child's lack of gratitude. And so you say, well, listen, I need to disciple my child in how to be grateful. And so all of a sudden now the whole conversation is about your child not being grateful for you bailing them out of their responsibility. And you realize, wait a minute, we have gone way left of what the actual issue is. So you created a false peace, which then created a whole nother issue that you started to believe was the real issue. But actually the real issue was you didn't have the courage to speak honestly to your adult child and say, hey, you know how we talked about this? I'm not going to clean this up for you. So if you do this again, you're going to have to cook your food somewhere else, you know, or whatever the recourse is, right? But the point is, so that's a domestic example that feels safe for us maybe, but there are dozens of versions of this in church where someone comes in and adjusts the soundboard and you're like, why do they do that? Here, I'll just adjust it back. Rather than have the conversation, you're like, it's just easier to fix this, or they moved the piano, or they did this, and you're like, well, let's just move it back, it'll be fine. Rather than saying, you know, we had a conversation about this. And so we paper over these conflicts, not knowing that we're actually setting ourselves up for a more explosive one coming.
Okay, I do have a personal example.
Okay, good.
It's painful. Yes. Okay, a few weeks ago, there's a couple in the church that's been trying to get together with Jason and me, and it's just, we've really been trying so hard to set healthy boundaries because we were at 5 nights a week easily, and we have 3 small kids.
And your boss was telling you not to do that.
Yes, he was. Good job. And so this new year, we set some healthy boundaries, and a couple said, hey, you know, we want to do that. I think they were wanting like 3 meetings between like having us over, and then she wanted to do coffee with me, and he wanted to do coffee with Jason. And we just said, okay, we're in March scheduling right now, so let's put it on the calendar. And they got upset and said, everyone's so busy, and all we just want to, you know, get to know each other, and no one has time, and everyone's so busy. And the temptation for me in that moment was to somehow shove it into my calendar somewhere, some place that I had protected in the name of health, to all of a sudden, you know, push that away, be like, okay, Lord, you know, this is probably what you're calling me to do here, is just to not be so selfish with my time. Mm-hmm. And instead, I don't think I handled it well, but I did say, we're really, because I was angry, but I'm like, I said, no, we just planned ahead, and that's what we need to do, is plan ahead. But I could see in that moment that it was so tempting to just try to move the conflict out, to not have this interruption of whatever the peace or harmony is between us. Like, no, we really want to get together with you. You know what? We didn't. We actually didn't want to get together with these people. They're really hard, and that's the truth of the matter. And yet we're going to, because we know they are good people. Right. And we're called to be in communion with one another. But I don't need to shove that into the 11th hour of the week in order to make them happy.
So you should jump to number 9, okay, because that is, and come back to 8 afterwards.
Okay, but number 9.
But that is just perfect, isn't it? Because I've heard Pete Scazzaro say, the response is not, yes, I'm so busy. Because people will say that, I know you're busy, you know. The response is, yes, I'm busy. The response is, it's not that I'm busy, it's just that I have limitations. I have capacity. And I am saying yes, but I'm saying yes within my own limitations. And the lie that we believe as Christian leaders is that everyone else has limits, but not us. We don't have limits. We are anointed. Like, so we have, there's something special about us. We don't have limits, right? Instead of recognizing we do. Right. So talk about that.
Well, ironically, I think you said it all. We're human beings. And when we don't live as human beings, when we live without limits, we are essentially putting ourselves in the same place as God, which is just wrong. Jesus modeled this for us. He did not heal every sick person in Palestine. He only ministered for 3 years. He didn't feed all of the hungry beggars that he ever met. He did not leave Palestine, you know, completely different and completely pure than the way that he found it. But he was with people in the present moment in the capacity that he had. And also, as we see from the Gospels, he was constantly trying to get away from people. Right. I just need a hot minute. You know. Just back to the point about the couple in our calendar. I also noticed when we did finally get a calendar date in March, I thought, you know, if I would have tried to, you know, shove them into my life somewhere, I would have entered into that time with them hurried, hustling, yeah, resentful, you know, probably putting on a fake happy face and deep down not being happy. But as I look at that date on the calendar, you know, 6 weeks from now, 7 weeks from now, there's actually a small bit of joy and appreciation, a small bit that's growing.
And you've processed your anger already.
Processed my anger.
Put it before the Lord.
That's right. Yeah. And that gives me time for God to come to me and say, this is what I want for your experience with these people. This is what I want for them. This is what I want for you. This is good that you're meeting together, which had I, you know, tried to please them would have gone terribly, I think.
So good.
Okay, what, you want to go back to,
yeah, go back to 8. Yeah.
Number 8, covering over brokenness, weakness, and failure. This just goes back to this pressure that we have to present an image of ourselves as spiritually together. And we feel guilty for not measuring up, and then we do things to cover up that guilt, and it just is this vicious cycle of false coverings until we don't even know how to articulate our limits, our failures, our weaknesses. But Scripture doesn't spin the flaws of its own, you know, heroes of the faith, so to speak. There's an element of each person's weakness that, as Paul says, ends up becoming the place where the glory of God is most evident. Like, this is the gospel, the fact that we are not our own rescuer and savior. This is the gospel, and if we cannot live that out, that is not to say that we make excuses for our weaknesses by saying, oh, I just, right. you know, I couldn't do any better. I'm just a human.
Christians
I've got limitations.
Aren't perfect, just forgiven.
Right,
yeah.
right. But to actually hold in tension the fact that we want to be like God, and yet we cannot in and of our own strength, is to hold the truth of the gospel with us at all times. And so the way that we do that is by recognizing when we start to spin things or justify things. Small example of this, for years I convinced myself that I was really good at handling conflict. Because in my family, conflict was on the table, and we raised our voice, and we talked about it right then. It wasn't allowed to sit. We were hardly allowed to take a time out from one another. It was like, no, you get it done right here. Well, the feeling after we got conflict worked through was like, oh, I love you, I appreciate you, etc. But until recently, when my own husband has pointed out, you interrupt me all the time. I didn't realize that part of my own family history that I think is so great, oh, we're so good at conflict, is that we also run over people because we want the conflict to get worked out right now, even if that's not what someone else wants. Mm. And so to really own that and sit with it and even grieve, I thought this was okay. I didn't realize that this was like a failure on my part that now needs to be addressed. Oh, it's so frustrating, but so good and healthy at the same time.
Man. That's good. I think about this when I get emails from people about the sermon. You know, do you ever get those? No. And there's always someone who either mishears what you've said or is a little bit bothered that you didn't also say these other things that they are really passionate about as well. And so the hardest thing is to say, yeah, you know what? I think I was like overemphasizing this one point, and I could have done a better job representing that. Because that's not what I feel in the moment. What I feel in the moment is, shut up, man. Like, I just spent 10 hours, like, you preach. You can't say all the stuff, right? No, just being candid here. I hope that's okay. But in those moments, to say, yeah, actually, I do have limitations too, or I did misspeak, or when legitimately it wasn't just a matter of emphasis, but I actually went too far on a point. To say, yeah, you know, that you're right about that. I shouldn't have said that. I wish I would have said it this way now, you know, or that sort of thing. Those are all examples that we can, let's put it this way, that we can relativize the power differential between clergy and laity. One of the things I think Paul is up to in the epistles is he doesn't ignore power differentials. That's a reality of life. There are structures. There are people that are in charge. There are people who are not. Paul's not a Marxist. He's not trying to eliminate power differentials. But what he's trying to say is that in Christ, power gets relativized because in the end, we all are answerable to Christ. And what emotionally healthy spirituality looks like is it looks like an awareness of that, that actually Christ is all of our masters. And actually, I am submitting to you as you are submitting to me. And there is a reverence for Christ here, even if we are in different roles. Even if there are power structures that put me with the microphone and the congregation not. Okay, but let me also still say that we are before Christ. And parents, by the way, can do this when we repent to our children. I mean, one of the greatest gifts my parents gave me was being able to come and say to me, I shouldn't have lost my temper today. I'm really sorry. Will you forgive me? And power differentials in Asia, where I grew up, are extremely high. Parents don't do that. But my parents did because of the influence of the gospel. And that's what the gospel does. It doesn't erase power differentials, but it relativizes them. And I think that's an example of one of the reasons we don't want to share our weakness or our failure. And I think there's an unhealthy way to do that too, by the way. There's a sense in which vulnerability becomes voyeuristic and you just stand up. And by the way, there's whole podcasts and authors who write like this. So the whole point of the book is what a mess I am. And that's not the gospel either, right? So we don't want to swing to the other extreme. Vulnerability is not an end in itself. But vulnerability as a means for demonstrating and displaying the power of grace, that glorifies God.
Good. Okay, let's do the last one real quick, judging the spiritual journey of others. And Pete, when he writes on this, says, you know, as a he went into, you know, full-time ministry, so to speak, he was a really young age, and he really took on that it was his responsibility to correct people who were in error, to stand up to people who are living in sin, or to counsel people that are mixed up spiritually. And so it became very commonplace for him to just not realize that he was actually, you know, sizing up someone's spirituality at all times. And I think this is so easy for us to fall into, especially when we're taught to compare ourselves to the world and make sure we're not falling into the way that everybody else does things. It's so easy to, in the spirit of you know, good comparison, to then get into a value judgment at the same time. And so falling into this is just living out the whole log in the eye parable. And we really need to own the extensive damage that sin has done in every part of who we are. Our own emotions, our own intellect, our body, our will, our spirit. All of the depth of our incapacity for righteousness has to be owned without comparing ourselves to other people. So maybe three ways that we notice that we're falling into this trap is that we're comparing ourselves to other people as a way to feel better about ourselves or to ignore our own issues. Maybe a way to feel more in control of the things that we struggle with. Or thirdly, just by accidentally falling into that because we feel uncomfortable about the way someone else is living their life. It can be very easy when we're recognizing this dissonance. We're like, oh, this is not the way that I think is good or preferable. But it can so easily, instead of a yearning for someone's wholeness, turn into a judgment, a value judgment at the same time. So when we judge the spiritual journeys of others, we find ourselves occupied with other people's faults, then we are falling into an unhealthy emotionally spirituality.
That's good. Okay, let's talk a little bit about structure for the rest of this time together. We're going to take a break at some point here to give you a little rest, but does a 15-minute break sound adequate? Yes? So that gives us then about 7 minutes or so to just have a little discussion in here all together. And then I'll tell you, at 2:30, what we're going to do is we thought the best way to really do this is to actually practice one of the tools. So there's 8 different tools in emotionally healthy spirituality? Or are they not all tools necessarily? I guess there's practices.
There's 8 in relationships, and then, I can't
remember. Yeah, not exactly.
They get complicated,
But to take one of these practices and to say, let's work through that together. So at 2:30, we'll do a genogram together. And I do want to state this in case you're tempted to say, maybe I should not come back at 2:30, this is what they used to say back in our ropes course college days, was this is challenged by choice. Meaning, if you start to feel like, this is more unearthing than I want to do right now, that's okay. Just pause. You don't have to go there. Just stay in the room and listen to how it's processed and how it's taught. Sarah will kind of talk through biblically the idea of generations and generational sin, what that is and is not, and may or may not look like. And then we'll kind of map that through. I'll give some examples of how doing a genogram helped me in my own leadership and pastoral vocation. So there will be time for you to work through one on your own. But as I said, that piece of it is a challenge by choice, if you will. But let's take 5 minutes here in the room and just any thoughts, comments, additional insights or questions that you might have.
Would anyone be so bold as to say, this is one or two that I really resonate with? This is an invitation for me.
So how do you guys, it sounds like you regularly keep doing rotating discipleship and relationships. How do you weave what I'm assuming is your small group ministry into that? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you keep that going and also encourage people to go to that?
So we toyed around with, at first, hey, let's resource our small groups to go through this together. And over time realized that's a common thing that churches try to do, and it ends up being sort of a mediocre experience for people. So we actually kept it out of small group specific ministry and are literally running it as a course. So a once a week 8 weeks, but a small group can experience it together because during that course you sit at tables and you go through the course at your same table the whole time.
And our small groups meet at the requirement, quote unquote, for a small group at church is meet at least, I think it's even just once a month, isn't it? Once or twice a month for a semester, so from January to May, versus this being an 8-week run and then it's over. So we run them as separate things. It has not hurt our small group ministry. In fact, if anything, it's imported in common language and common practice so that when people are at their small groups, they're like, oh, I was doing that too, and did you do the course last year, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it keeps it from being like, okay, the capacity of the small group leader or the interest level of the small group leader makes the experience for everyone else. We've kind of kept it out of that and just said, hey, there's one or two people running this. It's run the same way every time. And so everyone's having the same experience, and then they can contextualize it themselves. I have had other small groups, though, maybe go through the book again together and say, okay, let's take one or two of these sessions and really flesh it out as a small group and get really honest about our experiences. But every time I've known of a group that's taken, tried to go through just themselves with the book or whatever, they kind of fall off the map a little bit.
Is this interesting? Is this helpful? Is this, yes? Okay, good. Yeah.
Hi, this is more comment than it is question per se, but I guess I'd love to hear your comments on these comments, if it would be. I did quite a bit about 15, 20 years ago, did a lot of healing prayer and kind of, you know, sort of working into some of these kind of issues. And I think a couple things that I was just noticing as we were going through these things is that I think there was a part of me, I don't think it was entire, but I think there was a part of me that in some of these things saw these things as kind of the bad things to do. And so if you stop doing these bad things, then somehow you're healthy. In the sense of, you know, that I would sort of be very honest about my past, and I'd want to, you know, try to be as honest as I could about sadness and anger and brokenness and pain and yada, yada, yada. But not that those things are trivial, I'm not trying to say that, but in the sense that these are, you know, to be able to look at this more as symptoms of an underlying issue, that what we're really trying to aim at is a much sort of deeper sense of health or true self or whatever that is. And I think it's also something that the other thing that I'm just thinking about as we're going through this, is that it's not really a choice to make if I just choose tomorrow, okay, I'm going to start telling my story and doing these things, and I'm going to choose this, I'm going to choose this, I'm going to choose this, mm-hmm. That really it's much more of, you know, choosing in the big picture. I think that's more what I did initially, was chose to sort of try to be healthy in the big picture rather than try to choose to be healthy in every little momentary picture, and that's really where health kicks in, and it usually happens because there's a lot of pain mm-hmm. of other kinds mm-hmm. and that the pressure sort of comes in to the point where you really need to make those kind of choices just to sort of make it through the day. But I think that it's that getting to that point of really making those kind of day-to-day, moment-by-moment choices, that's where health really starts beginning mm-hmm. to be more than just a big picture, I'm going to be healthy now. Kind of idea.
Right. We talk about a concept called JNC, or just noticeable change. So these symptoms, and I'm glad you pointed that out, the difference between do this, don't do this, and well, this is just a symptom. This may be, you know, a spotlight on an area that is in need of transformation. So these are 10 symptoms that we go through at the beginning of the course, but then the rest of the course is on, well, then what? Mm-hmm. So if you've highlighted something, then how do you address that? And these are, yes, they're big, big picture ideas, like going back to go forward, or, you know, as I said earlier, journeying through the wall. What does feeling stuck in your spirituality say about your place or what God is doing in your life, or things like grief, but also things like spiritual practices, yes. Sabbath, the daily office, etc. So there are practical things that we encourage people to embrace in their own way in order to see that slight shift that, you know, almost like if you were following a course, if you go off that course, even a few degrees, you know, a month from now, walking that same way, you're in a completely different place. So instead of it being like, my entire life has to shift, and all of a sudden I have to be fasting 3 days a week, and I need to make sure I'm visiting a therapist weekly, etc. What are the just noticeable things that rise to the surface when we give attention to this, that the Lord is saying,